Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive catalogue of films brings together cinema from around the globe, going back over a century. The full library is over 6,000 titles strong, including family favourites such as Early Man and Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, blockbusters for a nice quiet night in, including Cliffhanger and Rambo First Blood Part 2, and flat-out classics like Alphaville and The Elephant Man. And we're going to do our very best to explore it all in this podcast. This time round, we're taking a little bit of a different approach. With Studio Canal's new British romantic treat, What's Love Got to Do with It, heading into UK cinemas on Friday the 24th of February, I sat down with one of the film's stars, comedian, writer, director and actor Asim Chowdhury. Asim and I discuss his scene-stealing performance in What's Love Got to Do with It, but as you're about to hear, the heart of this conversation is us digging into his list of favourite movies of all time, from the eerie sci-fi Under the Skin to modern French masterpiece A Prophet. But let's just kick off with a clip of Asim as Mo the Matchmaker in What's Love Got to Do with It.
Asalaamu Alaikum, Mo here, Mo the Matchmaker. And if you're looking for a suitable match for your son, then you've come to the right place. We do daughters as well. Brother, have a look at these and tell me what you think.
No photos?
No photos yet, pictures? Because think about it. If she's too fit, then you won't know if she's a good fit, okay? You're going to see the picture. Yeah. You're thinking with your lulu. You need to be thinking with your nunu, okay?
I'm delighted to be joined by Asim Chowdhury. Hello, Asim. How do we find you?
I'm very good. How do we find? I like the way you said that.
Thank you very much.
You find me very well.
I've been
content.
On a course. And
yeah,
everything.
Very warm and fuzzy. That's
how I think so.
That's how you find me.
I'm here to out you.
Oh, God. I've been cancelled so soon.
Well, give it a bit of time.
Right.
So I found you on Letterboxd.
Oh, no.
I'm no, not that. No, not that account. The app.
Oh, good.
So I found the inverted commas official account where you listed 100 of your greatest films of all time.
Yeah, that was a lonely weekend.
And a very productive and a very good weekend as well. A lot of Robert De Niro, a lot of mob films in there, but also a few, helpfully on brand for this particular podcast, from the Studio Canal catalogue, almost as if you knew when you put that list together a couple of years ago that one day we would be here and sharing this moment.
I manifested it.
And so I wonder, can I just ask you about a couple of those films and why they make your 100 greatest films of all time?
Yes.
So first of all, there's Adventures of a Plumber's Mate. Sorry, wrong list.
That's the burner account.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a film I think is extraordinary, but I just never want to watch it again, but also do, which is Under the Skin.
Oh, wow.
Now, that was a noise, and I hope podcasts can pick that up. Could you do that again? Could you give me another take?
Oh, wow.
My life.
It's one of the few films that I watched alone. I mean, first of all, I watch all movies alone in the cinema.
Okay.
I've been doing this for the last 6-7 years.
But
I don't go
choice,
to the cinema.
Or...
Yeah. I don't go to the cinema with my friends or my wife. Oh, God forbid I go with my wife because she's one of the, you know, wait, who's he? Wait, so that... And I'm going, shut up! I don't like that.
Okay.
I like to watch films alone. Predominantly, I do, even at home. So I remember watching this film on my own in the cinema. And I just remember... This is one of the few experiences where I left the cinema and I started looking at other humans and realizing that we are aliens. You know, like our fingers. Yeah. Like, this looks normal to us, right? But if you think about it, we are weird. And that film was such a visceral experience for me where it made me question of, like, what is... normality and what are humans and aliens. I mean, we are aliens. So it had that effect on me. And then, of course, with the music and just the kind of... It was so surreal, but also very real.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was brilliant. And I know some of the scenes were filmed, you know, without people knowing that they were filming. And it has that really... And it stayed with me. It really, really stayed with me, that film. And I don't know if it's a horror or a sci-fi or what it is, but I just thought it was brilliant and so original.
Excuse me. I'm a bit lost, really. Am I headed towards Tenault?
Yeah.
I am. Is it far?
It's about 10 minutes away.
10 minutes? Are you headed there?
I'm going to the supermarket.
I remember when it first came, when news of it first came out, and it was just shots of, here's Scarlett Johansson in Glasgow, and that was it. And no one knows what she's doing in there, yeah. And people weren't really aware of the film at that time. But I just wonder, in terms of, for you, trying to reach into the film industry as well, do you look at a film like that being made in Glasgow with a Greggs in it, in the back? But, you know, that's what I remember, Scarlett Johansson driving past Greggs. But it sort of makes all of that reachable, doesn't it?
It does.
Not least Greggs.
Yeah, it sounds like you're trying to get a little deal with Greggs here. I like the way you just put that in. You're trying to get the Greggs black card.
Thank you very much.
I could have a word for you, mate. Don't
Is
worry.
That actually a thing?
Yeah, it's a thing. I'll get you steak bakes on tap, mate.
Okay.
Yes, it's wonderful to see that. You know, if you see one of the most, you know, famous and one of the most beautiful, you know, Hollywood actresses ever, right, of our generation, you know, and for her to see, like you said, you know, in Glasgow outside of Greggs, that's why it was such a weird movie as well. But I totally get why she did it. I'd like to read that script, actually, just because of I'd like to see how they worded some of the action and, you know, how they conveyed that, because she must have read that and thought, this is bonkers, I'm going to do it.
It was a Brad Pitt film at one point, wasn't it?
Really?
Yeah, it was because Jonathan Glazer had spent so long trying to get the film made. Originally, it was a much bigger budget alien movie. Wow. And he just what was it, 15 years or so? 10, 15 years he was trying to get it going. And he just kept paring it down and paring it down and paring it down.
But, you know, that's brilliant, though.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great lesson for loads of film writers. You know, sometimes if you take away all the kind of, you know, all the glitz and glamour of your film, and you realise, what's the core of this story here?
Yeah.
You know, what's it about? And it's about being human and feeling like an alien. And what is it to be an alien? What is it to be a human? You know, it was really, really beautifully done. And a lot of these big sci-fi films, the actual core of them are very human story. And I watched Arrival the other day for the first time, which I absolutely loved. And, you know, that film is obviously on a massive scale and shot beautifully. It's a very, very simple story about trauma and loss, you know, and about pain. And you think, that's what great movies are. You know, you strip away all that stuff and what have you got left? And if you're creative enough to still convey that onto screen, then, you know, and I think that's another reason why I really loved it, because it did have big ideas, but done in a very, very kind of simplified, very, very human way.
You're uncomfortable?
No. Just want to go to Tesco's.
But when you came to making your own short film, Love, Paul,
yeah.
I mean, it almost sounds like you had a little bit of that ethos yourself, that you were working within the parameters, and you, it's like you got the ingredients you could afford, the ingredients you could get, and channeled it into the story you wanted. Would that be a fair reflection of that? Because it's a really, really wrong-footing film. I really enjoyed it a lot.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, that was actually, you know, yeah, of course, it's a short film. You're working with limited budgets, a lot of favours called in. But yeah, that was originally based on my real life. You know, that was the thing that I was single. I was in a restaurant when all my friends were coupled up, like really gross, you know, like lovey-dovey, all in the honeymoon
stage.
You're
the perfect person to make a rom-com.
And I thought, and I remember this really, one of my mate's girlfriends, really annoying. She's not with him anymore, so I can say it. She was like, Asim, when are you going to sell down? When are you going to? I was like, oh, shut up. You know, and it was just this pressure of like I was happily... Well, happily, I was single. I liked being single, but there was this pressure of, but I was also, I always romanticized love. You know, I had an unhealthy version of love. I'd watch Woody Allen films and all this stuff, and I'll find the one, and there's someone out there for me, and I'm going to find it. And then I had that thing actually happened. I ended up in an Uber, and I thought it was a normal Uber, but it was an Uber pool. And I met this girl, and we had a great 10 minutes together, laughing, joking. I was drunk. And then when I got out of the car, I took her number, my phone actually fell down a drain, but that was too unrealistic. So the themes for that film are about, you know, finding the one and an unhealthy romanticized version of love that I think we've seen from women's point of view. But I thought, you know, men feel that too. You know, we can be soppy and emotional and, you know, ridiculous with love, you know, because we think love is this one thing when really love is not so simple. You know, it's not, the one isn't real. You can't find the one. The one doesn't exist. It's about compromise. It's about not falling into love, but walking into love, like, you know, they say.
It's interesting you saying that, and the rom-com that you've been cast in, what's love got to do with it? I'm sure you've been asked this a lot, but it doesn't play by the conventions necessarily of what we're expecting of a traditional romantic comedy, whatever one of those is. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just wonder if you can just talk about that a little bit, because even your character in this film, Mo the Matchmaker, whenever we see like arranged marriage, put on screen, for instance, it's not portrayed in any kind of positive way.
No.
You know, we're told that arranged marriage is entirely bad. Mm-hmm. And then in comes you, sitting behind this desk, loading up your computer and with a credit card machine presumably just within reach. Can you talk to me about the importance of putting a character like Mo the Matchmaker across?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it's a very culturally important character and it has all this depth to it. You know, it's a fun cameo, but the reality of it is, though, is, you know, marriage is a big business as well.
Yeah.
But also, like you said, you know, the themes of arranged marriage or assisted marriage or love marriage, they're explored in here in a very honest way.
Yeah.
You know, it goes to show someone like Mo, who's probably, you know, benefiting. I've even got a mug that, you know, that Jemima made for me that says, Mo marriage, Mo money. People like Mo the Matchmaker are real. You know, I grew up in Hounslow where you get those kind of, you know, I mean, Chabuddy is a great example, just a wheeler dealer kind of character who's always an opportunist, who's looking for any kind of moment to benefit, you know. But you know, I've got a funny story about me being Mo the Matchmaker in real life. So one of my friends, you know, who I went to school with in Hounslow, he's this adorable little short Indian guy with freckles. I call him my little penguin. He's adorable. You'd love him.
Okay.
He messaged this girl that we used to go to school with on Facebook for quite a few years back. He put in the WhatsApp chat. He was like, bro, I messaged her and she didn't reply back. I was like, okay, mate, send me the screenshot of what you sent. And I read the message and it was absolutely horrific. It was like, yo, babes, you're looking sexy, innit? Let me take you to like all bar one and we go for a few cocktails. And I was like, of course she didn't reply back to you. Literally sounded like an illiterate creep. Like it was very weird. So yeah. I was like, what I'll do for you, mate. I was like, let me take over. I'll ghostwrite for you and I'll get you the date. Then after that, it's up to you. It's on you. So I was ghostwriting for him, going, sorry about that last message. I was just playing around. Thing is, I'm really nervous because I really used to fancy in school. And then she went back, well, you never spoke to me in school. Yeah, because I was so nervous. I was going on for weeks, 2-3 weeks, right?
So then, you're a modern day Cyrano de Bergerac.
Exactly what Jeff said. And then I got him the date. 6-7 years later, married, 2 kids.
Are you the godparent of
I was the best man.
Well, of course.
Well, yeah, I mean,
I'd take 10%, surely. Yeah.
Well, I mean, she's in love with me, not him.
I mean, if you want to name names on this podcast, it will go where the Studio Canal Presents podcast hasn't been before. But, you know, I'm interested in this new direction.
So Platinum Services, they also include me checking out the girl's family, seeing that she's from a good family home, nice, tidy, clean.
Okay, so guys, tell me, what kind of lovely lady are we looking for today?
Someone intelligent and attractive and who I click with. I suppose.
People keep talking about this clique, you know. He needs a companion, not a clique.
Mm. Okay, no, just someone who can tolerate my parents.
You know, a girl from the same background,
gotcha.
Soft-spoken, long hair, not too dark. Wheatish complexion at the most.
Wheat, really? Beige.
Did you bring your Pantone colour chart?
Just while we're on this role of Mo the Matchmaker, I mean, it just looks like you're having an extraordinary amount of fun. Mm-hmm. And I think there's an assumption a lot of time that when someone's sat having a lot of fun in a comedy, it's all improvised and stuff. But how much was written down? Because I see a lot of comedy that's supposed to be improvised, that's scripted, and vice versa.
Yeah, for this scene, it was scripted. But
yeah.
I think a lot of the stuff that you're seeing on the screen, probably 50-50 is improv because, you know, Jemima just slid in my DMs and was like, look, I want you in my movie. We love
you.
My kids love you. They're obsessed with you. What role do you want to play? And I read the script and I thought, I'll play a little cameo role, fun role.
Yeah.
So they changed
the Mo the Matchmaker role was up, a woman. Wasn't it?
Sorry?
Lily's role was up. You could have had that.
I could have, yeah.
Opportunity missed there.
Exactly. Would have been a different film, but...
I'd have watched it.
Yeah, same.
By myself.
By yourself. Yep. Well, there we go. You have to. They let me be free. You know, Shekhar Kapoor, he was like, look, I don't really do comedy. He was like, you're the comedy man. You know, feel free. So they let me. I did a few takes and then very loose takes. But it's right what you said, actually, because if you watch The Office, the UK one.
Scripted to the bone.
Yeah, scripted to the bone. And then, you know, something like People Just Do Nothing. We also script to the bone, but it's probably around 70-30, you know, 30 being improv that ends up. And I love a bit of improv. You know, I think you can always get that kind of spontaneous kind of takes and that freedom, which I love.
Yeah.
So it was just fun. You know, I came and did a couple of scenes and had a laugh.
He's a doctor.
Oof, no, listen, top of the food chain.
See?
Easy. And any vices I should know about? Any drinking, smoking, dogging, S&M, anything like that?
None.
Okay, Uncle Auntie, I will find your son a brilliant match. You don't worry about that. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
No dogs, no pets.
No, dogging means something. Don't worry.
Cats are okay.
Cats are...
Okay. I like cameos sometimes. I prefer them to big roles because then it's like, you know, 6 weeks every day. It's a graft.
Yeah.
If I can come and do two scenes and still have an impact, end up on the poster with two scenes, quality over quantity, you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, if there's a flaw in your film career, if you don't mind me pointing out, if we go back to your first, I'm so on brand, your first ever Studio Canal production was Paddington,
yeah.
where you are security guard uncredited.
I got cut out, yeah.
Uncredited in brackets on yeah. IMDb. That's got to hurt.
I'll tell you what will hurt you even more is when I tell you about the story. I went there. I did a scene with Nicole Kidman. And I thought, wow,
there's a sentence.
This was very early days. This was like, yeah. I don't know what, People Just Nothing probably just started. And I went to this really funny scene with Nicole Kidman. Went to take my little sister, I think you believe was maybe 8 or 9 at the time. Went to the premiere, sat next to flipping Kate Moss. And I'm thinking, here's my big my moment.
Oh, no.
And then I'm checking my emails while I'm there. And I get an email from the director saying, Asim, I'm so sorry. I forgot to tell you, but your scene's cut. And then bless my little sister's heart. She was, you know, this little baby, 7, 8 years old. And then at the end of the film, she was just like, pretended I was in it. She was going, and I liked your bit.
Oh, that's
and
I'm lovely.
Going, yes, my bit. So she just pretended I was in it.
So do you edit IMDb to put in security guard brackets
I don't
uncredited?
Know. I want
is
to
that
remove,
your work?
No, I want to remove it because I'm not in it. I don't even know how it's in there.
Another of the films on your top 100 of all time was Prophet.
Yeah.
How's this for a tonal shift?
Wow. Yeah.
And what a tour de force of a movie that is from Jacques Audier. I believe I pronounced that correctly. So I'm assuming you watched this in a cinema by yourself.
I remember watching this at uni, actually.
Really?
On my own, yeah. On my own. I remember I got it on DVD or something. I can't remember. But I just remember being so haunted by it, you know. And it's one of those... It's, you know, it's a gangster film.
Yes.
You know, it's a crime film and a prison film and all those things. But it's really a film about the soul and a tortured soul and, you know... the haunting of one's trauma, what they've done in their life and how they have to live with it, you know, and that
yeah.
whole character, you know, with his throat and he talks to him and, oh, it's just, it's so chilling. And he was brilliant in it, you know, I mean, what an incredible performance. And I would say it's up there as one of my favorite, you know, French films of all time. It's absolutely brilliant. And I think it's underrated because everyone goes, oh, Goodfellas and this and that
yeah.
and, you know, all these really cool films, and you think, well, no, that should be right up there.
Well, my memory of A Prophet was it got a lot of noise at the time,
yeah.
and you're thinking, this is going to culturally endure, and I think you're right, it's dropped out of the consciousness a little bit, but it's also, once you've seen it...
It stays with you.
It really yeah. stays with you, and I think it's interesting, you've picked Under the Skin and you've picked A Prophet, and these are two films that you don't necessarily rush to go back and watch straight away,
yeah.
but they stick with you for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, The Prophet, actually, I rewatched recently, and I thought it was even better the second time round.
Well, tell me why. What was enriched by the second viewing?
Well, I think, and the first viewing, I was obviously a young, you know, whatever, early yeah. 20s, so I watched it being like, oh, gangster, yeah, prison, oh, sick, you know, all that stuff, oh, the riot, oh, wicked, oh, sick, Tony Montana, you know, all that stuff. And then, obviously, as a more mature man,
yeah.
you watch it and you think, wow, this is not a gangster film. And again, you know, when we were talking about when you strip away all the stuff, you strip
yes.
away the prison and the gangsters and the come up and the assassins and the hits, and you think, what's this about? What is this film about? And actually, you know, that's something I've learned from writing as well. You know, if you can't find the core of your idea,
yeah.
and you need to be like, well, listen, it's set in the future and there's these space aliens and this happens and that, you're like, well, listen, I don't care about any of that. What's your film about? You know, what's the core? And that's what I learned on the second viewing, is that it's about this, it's about, you know, some stuff that you've done that will never go away and it will stay with you and haunt you no matter how successful or rich or happy you become. That ghost is going to be with you forever. It's like your shadow. So it's like, that's what I learned, you know. It was very dark, but brilliant film.
So if you were to set up a further alt account on Letterboxd,
yeah.
your official one, then we've got your fruity one.
Yeah.
But if you've got one for films that are almost like second watch films, because I think this is a bit of a thing. I find this a lot with Edgar Wright films. It's mm-hmm. the second watch that gets me. Would A Prophet rank even higher for you?
Yeah, I think that's a great shout. I think it would. And I actually told a few of my friends to rewatch that film. You know, because we all watched it when we were younger. So, you know, it was quite a popular film amongst my friends. But I was like, you know, I told them, you need to rewatch that because there's so many things that you're going to pick up. You know, it's like, I mean, I know this is, you know, doesn't need any more shouting than it deserves, but Parasite is one of those. I remember
yes.
I watched Parasite for the first time, loved it, watched it again, loved it even more. By the third time, it was like a heavenly experience. I was ascending, thinking of all these things and realizing that what's actually happened here is such a genius movie.
Yes.
And, you know, I actually rewatched Memories of a Murder as well, Bong's
yeah,
serial
yeah.
killer film. Again, you have to rewatch that, because the tone and the pacing of that film is just, it's just gorgeous, you know. So I think I'd highly recommend second watches for films. You know, I rewatched Tar.
Yeah.
The second time around, that film's even better, because the first time you're confused, you're like, there's so much exposition going on here. It starts off with a 20-minute interview and you're like, what's going on here?
It's like this, actually.
Yeah, it's like
this. This is our remake of Tar.
It's like that, exactly.
I'm looking forward to seeing what you do next and who you upset.
How am I going to get cancelled? Probably by my fourth Letterboxd account that you hopefully don't find out.
I won't tell anybody. Very dark. It's our secret, I assume. Don't you worry. I'm going to pick one of the other films that was on your list as well, because I remember watching this. I'd not read anything about it. I'd not seen a trailer, and it's still one of the best WTF films I've seen in a cinema, and it's Four Lions.
Oh, yeah.
And it was only afterwards I read a statement from Chris Morris about what the catalyst for Four Lions was for him, about how he read this story of a bunch of terrorists loading up a boat with explosives and weaponry, and the boat sank, and he laughed, and he found himself involuntarily laughing at something he felt he shouldn't laugh at.
Yeah.
I'm sort of a great believer in that's the kind of thing that comedy should do and comedy should explore. And I'm intrigued, given your extensive comedy background, what your perspective is on that film and why it charts so highly.
Oh, I mean, I could talk about Four Lions forever. I mean, I will name drop here.
Okay.
Chris is a good friend of mine.
Do you want to call him up now and just get him in?
Give him a little FaceTime if you want. He's a good friend of mine, and actually I've been writing with him for the last maybe 3 years now on something very secret.
Five Lions.
Five Lions. And what I would say about Four Lions is I remember this is a film I did watch with friends.
Yeah.
When it first came out. All my Hounslow, British Pakistani friends, Muslim. Yeah. And we all went to watch this film in Hounslow, in Felwham Cineworld. It was the cinema was packed with Asian people.
Yeah.
And here's a comedy written by a white man that is about four, you know, Pakistani terrorists, British-born terrorists. And you think, bloody hell, this is going to be the most offensive, tone-deaf thing ever. But the difference here is that you've got the genius Chris. And I say genius, and I mean that, because that gets thrown around a lot. But this guy is a genius, right?
Yes.
Like, comedy genius, satirical genius, whatever you want to say. And when I tell you this movie, the laughter in this film, tonally, he got everything right, because he knows so much about this subject.
Yeah.
And he knows how the tone works. With comedy, it's all about tone, right? You say one joke in one way, it can, you know, bang the next time. Excuse the expression. I know we're talking about terrorism. And it can flop, you know. But he knows more about Muslims and Pakistan than I do. And he would be telling me facts about stuff. He would make me feel white.
Yeah.
I felt white when I was around with him. And he just understands that comedy, again, let's strip away everything, right? We talked about Under the Skin.
Yeah.
Strip away the fact this guy's a terrorist and he's got bombs. What makes this character funny? He's deluded. You know, he's insecure. He's paranoid. These are human qualities that can all be very humorous. And if done in the right way, we end up liking the terrorists in this film.
Yeah.
You know, Riz Ahmed's character is really likable. Kayvan, you know, he's a moron. We love him. He's going to blow up and kill innocent people. And that is the genius of Four Lions. You know, it's creating sympathy for the devil in a hilarious way. And hysteria, I've always said this, hysteria can be hysterical. So, you know, how they're so hysterical about everything and the hysteria. Oh, we got to blow up boots. And it's brilliant. And at the core of it, that's what it is. It's these losers who don't fit in anywhere. They just want to be accepted. And if acceptance means strapping a bomb on your chest and blowing up boots, then so be it, you know? And it's funny. And
well, that's the thing,
isn't it? It's funny. It's funny. It's ridiculous, hysterical. And that's why Chris Morris is, you know, for me, the GOAT.
It's life, isn't it? It's just life. What is that? It's nothing. It's like being stuck in the queue at Alton Towers. Do you want to be in the queues or do you want to be on the rides? You want to be on the rides, don't you? You want to be on Nemesis or Oblivion?
Rubber Dinghy Rapids.
Yeah?
Yeah?
You with me?
Rubber Dinghy Rapids.
Yeah, Rubber Dinghy Rapids. Right?
Soldiers, brother.
Yeah, Mujahid.
Mujahid.
Come on. I mean, to be fair, you do call it your GOAT list and then you don't put it at number one.
No, because I don't think a comedy could ever be number one.
Oh, why?
I don't know. I don't think it can. And Four Lions is one of my favourite comedy films.
Yeah.
It's not my favourite comedy film of all time. But that's Big Lebowski, which
could be. And I noticed Step Brothers a bit further
Step
down
Brothers
the list, which
is
worth
well.
It for the whole bunk beds collapsing moment, of course.
My favourite bit in Step Brothers is when he goes, you know, it's a 40-year-old man, and she's going, can you just, you know, be nice to him, you know, to the stepdad? He's like, I'm not going to call him dad. She's like, you don't have to. And he went, even if there's a fire.
My favourite fact about Step Brothers is they shot more footage for Step Brothers than they did for Apocalypse Now.
Well, because of all the improv and stuff. Wow.
That would be Apocalypse Now, the studio canal. Do you see how I got that back on
brand?
That's
very nice. That happens with comedy. It happens with people just do nothing. You know, we always go over. People are, I mean, they love doing the job. But we had to, you know, even some of the camera. I mean, you know, the handheld stuff.
Yes.
You know, some people had serious injuries, you know, because we would be doing 30-minute improv takes. And you don't know when it's going to end, you know. But out of that, we will get some gold.
Just to tie up Four Lions, you mentioned there that it's funny. And written down, if you saw the synopsis of that before, the last thing you'd think it's a comedy.
Yeah.
And if it went to major funding bodies, etc., in the first instance, because he had to rattle tins to make that,
yeah,
didn't he?
Yeah, 10 years or something.
Yeah, and if it had gone the other way round, I can almost imagine it would be strip the comedy out. We've got to do this seriously. And yet, here is the film that's dealing with that subject matter that's endured perhaps more than any over the last 10, 15 years. And it's a comedy.
It's brilliant. And a funny story he told me about, I don't know if he's ever spoken about this before, but the character Barry, you know, the white convert extremist, he said that's based on a real guy who basically was this right-wing racist dude who basically started researching Islam so much, you know, to kind of know your enemy, that he accidentally converted himself. And I just think, that's genius, because that's what happens. You know, all these loony nutcases who are obsessed with racism and hating someone, they know more about that race than you do. So then they could actually, you could just be like, actually, maybe they've got a point. And they're very close. You know, all forms of extremism, whether it's a Muslim extremist or a right wing, they're basically the same. You know, they would agree with a lot of things, you know, like, you know, in America, you know, when you'd see the kind of really, you know, the KKK and then like, say, like a militant black leader, they would both say segregate. Yes, segregate, you know, go back home. Yes, we need our own land, you know. So it's like all forms of extremism, there's parallels there. And that can be funny. It's just about how you flip it and how you form it.
Which neatly brings us to this charming romantic comedy that we're here to talk about. What's Love Got to Do with It? I just wonder, can you kind of encapsulate the experience of being part of this? Because there just seemed to be a camaraderie on this one from the outside looking in.
Yeah, I mean, for me, as a British Asian, I think it's about time that we made a film. Yeah, it's a rom-com. Yes, it follows a lot of the conventions of rom-coms. It's working title, so you know it's going to follow those conventions.
Yeah.
And all the rom-com lovers are going to enjoy it, you know, because they know what they're getting into. But also, we're talking about arranged marriage and stuff in our culture that is always seen either as completely bad or completely good, right? Arranged marriage is terrible. Oh my God, how could you do that? Oh, yuck. You know, and then love marriage from the other side. Oh my God, that's haram. How dare you? You know, blah, blah, blah. Dating, oh my God. And this is just a very realistic grown-up representation of what it is like to find love.
Yeah.
You know, being any kind of race or culture. But specifically for British Asians, I think it's going to really resonate with them because they're going to be like, finally, like, I understand. Like, listen, arranged marriages doesn't have to all be bad.
Yeah.
And this whole assisted marriage thing is very interesting as well, because most hookups and relationships and marriages, they are all assisted in some way, whether it's Tinder or whether it's your mates or whether, you know, nowadays, how do you find love by what? You don't go into a library and you pick the same book and you look at each other and fall in love. That shit doesn't happen. That's not real, you know? So this is a much more realistic version of that stuff. And of course, like I said, it's a rom-com. It's going to feel like a nice pair of old jeans. It's going to fit just right. But it's something different about this, you know? It's got a bit of a...
Well, I like films with a moral as well. And I think the moral of this story is clearly, if you want to find love, to give you like a couple of £100, let you root through a few drawers and stuff, and then in 7 years' time, you'll insist on being the godparent of one of the children. Would that be fair?
Basically, yeah.
Lovely. I think we've got deal done. This has one of the finest last 20 minutes of a rom-com that I've seen this side of Tin Cup, because Tin Cup is obviously a masterpiece, and I'll defend that to my dying days. But there's a moment where a film screening takes place in the film, and I'm going as vague as possible. And that was the point where, for all us talking about its working title, it's the conventions of a rom-com, as much as the ingredients are different, where it really took me off in a completely different place. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering what your take on the turn of the film was, because I really got sideswiped by that. I really found it very moving. And I wasn't expecting to get that from this at all.
Yeah, no, same, actually. I think that's one of the most memorable bits in the film. And I think it's this whole notion of everyone's living a lie.
Yeah.
This lie that's pushed by the patriarchy of you must do this, you must do that, and everyone's happy, smile, and everything's fine. And, you know, that moment in the film is where it kind of slightly turns it and it really sets the film off in another direction, where the lies are kind of like, let's stop the lies. But also, you know, Lily's character, she's also lying.
Yeah.
You know, there's a huge amount, without any major spoilers, but there's a lot of hypocrisy going on there. And I think that's great because she's not this perfect, the white saviour to come and go, arranged marriage, what's that all about? Her life's a shambles too.
Yeah.
You know, so is love marriage the way? We don't know, you know, but it's like, and then it goes back to what's love got to do with it? Well, everything.
Asim Chowdhury, this has been a delight.
Nice one, thank you. Cheers.
A big thanks to Asim Chowdhury. And what's love got to do with it? It opens in UK cinemas on February the 24th. We've talked about a mix of films in this episode. You'll find Under the Skin, Four Lions and A Prophet on the Studio Canal Presents channel on Apple TV and Prime Video. You'll find Apocalypse Now on there too. You won't, however, find Step Brothers. Let's turn our attention to some other things happening in the world of Studio Canal. Now, I'm a huge physical media nerd, so I'm particularly interested in some upcoming releases on the 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray format. Sofia Coppola's debut film as director, The Virgin Suicides, is coming to DVD, Blu-ray and UHD disc in the UK on March the 13th. Now, it's the first time it's been on 4K in this country, and the restoration has been undertaken by Criterion, has been approved by Sofia Coppola and supervised by cinematographer Ed Lachman. The film, if you've not had the pleasure, it dates back to 2000, stars Kirsten Dunst and quickly marks Sofia Coppola out as a filmmaker of real note. I'm also getting whispers that Studio Canal will be releasing Jean-Pierre Jeunet's The City of Lost Children on 4K disc this year. More on that soon. Now, last episode, we chatted about a pair of Ealing films, the chilling 1940s double bill of Dead of Night and Queen of Spades. But here's something else from one of Britain's most legendary studios. Saraban for Dead Lovers is one of its lesser-known gems, dating back to 1948. It stars Stuart Granger and Joan Greenwood, with Basil Dearden behind the camera. It's a 17th century set historical drama and was the first Ealing Studios film to be shot in colour too. It arrives on the Vintage Classics DVD and Blu-ray label on March the 13th. One more film, just to put in your head. Sting is the spine-tingling new movie from Wormwood director Kia Roach-Turner and follows the unusual relationship between a young girl and a deadly spider. Stay tuned for news of Studio Canal's release plans for this one, but fair to say, should be perfect for the arachnophobes amongst you. And that's it for this episode of Studio Canal Presents. We'll be back next month for another dive into the Studio Canal catalogue. In the meantime, to find out more about Studio Canal films and the Apple TV and Prime Video channel, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on Twitter, Instagram and TikTok. And if you'd like to catch up on our previous episodes on everything from the blockbusters of Arnold Schwarzenegger to the new wave classic of Buddha Soof, you can find them all wherever you get your podcasts. Now though, I'm off to watch some more films on Asim Chowdhury's top 100 list. I'll see you soon for the next episode of Studio Canal Presents. Ta-ta for now.